Station number 21583, Mill 3.
Frank Moore, Rail 3.
We landed, or I landed in the first lift, on Sunday, the 17th of September, 1944. And I say we spent the first night roughly on the place where we landed. The next day, my battery, who was supporting the 1st Brigade, of which one battalion had reached the bridge, complete with my battery commander and the two troop commanders. We were supporting them, and we had to move forward to get within range. So we drove down the road towards Arnhem. There didn't seem to be much happening on this outskirts, this village of Oosterbeek. I remember we passed an abandoned sort of tram, and we were looking out all the way for somewhere where we could place our guns that wasn't surrounded in trees, which would prevent us from firing, because we couldn't to get the lower angle of sight, I think it was called. And we came across really the first place, which was some meadows near the church. And my troop went into a meadow, a little meadow, which had a bit of an orchard to it, just adjoining Oosterbeek Old Church, which was a Dutch Reformed church, very old church. And we had only three guns, because one of our guns, they had been not shot down, but the tow rope had broken, and it had landed somewhere in Holland. We heard about this. Our gun detachment had avoided being captured and so on at the time for this particular gun. So instead of having four guns, we only had three guns. But we put them in position in this little meadow, and we made the command post one of the transepts of this old church. And from there, we could control the guns, and we could also see the river from there. And we got the guns dug in and all prepared, and we started to fire the guns. We got communications from the bridge, from our battery commander. My troop commander, sadly, was wounded and taken prisoner and escaped later. He had quite an interesting story, and I've lost touch with him ever since. The other troop commander was also wounded, but came back to the gun position and had quite a battle there. But we were actually having quite a peaceful time. Our battery commander, our battery captain, had then received that evening a message from our colonel saying that our battery was far too exposed. We were on our own, no other British troops around us, and he felt that we should be moved back towards the rest of the division, which was nearer where we had landed. But in fact, it was, I think, at Hartestein, which is now the Airborne Museum. So he rang me up and said, Frank, would you... Now, I was called Peeps, because I was always called Peeps in the army, because I'm related more or less to Samuel Pepys, so this was sort of joke name I was always known by. He said, Sheriff Thompson wants you to report to him, but say we don't want to move, we're perfectly happy here. And I was brewing up, and this is the first food I'd had for since we'd landed, more or less. And I said, well, I want to brew up, and We had a little 24-hour packs, and you could think little things the size of matchboxes, which turned into meat and vegetable stew or something like that. And I was busy, and I said, well, I don't want to move. Anyway, I got my Jeep and driver and drove up, found the commanding officer, Sheriff Thompson, and we passed a bit of a mess. Something had been going on. It's obviously been a bit of a battle on the road, which was the one we'd originally come down on. And when I got to the colonel, he said, how did you get here? And I said, well, I came up this road. He said, we've just had a company wiped out or thereabouts on that road. He said, lead me back. I was much more scared leading him back where they had a company ambushed by Germans there. And anyway, I took him back, and he said, well, he said, it's a bit late now to move, so you better stay where you are. Which I always felt afterwards was a critical point in what happened to the battle, because we could see across these meadows to the river, which and we could really keep the Germans from getting between us and the river. Well, they got very close, I think, in the end, about 200 yards apart. But it was opposite us and the river, which was 200-300 yards away from us, that we got, the Poles came across, where we had some communication, and that's where we got across in the end when we were evacuated. But if we had moved, the Germans could have got right round the division, completely encircled us, I'm sure. And I often wondered whether that was realized by everybody afterwards. But it did enable us to... There was no one between us and the river. And that's where I say where we escaped at night in the end. Anyway, we stayed there, and we were on call. There was tremendous difficulty in the wireless reception, and in fact, one of the troop commanders was coming back to try and re-net the set, and I didn't hear till many, many years afterwards, that Arnhem was, I think they called it a black spot radio reception area, and I believe was the first city in Holland that had sort of cable television, because they had to put television way up, and it was some reason or other, radios were absolutely useless, and ours were particularly useless. I went out with an infantry patrol and got up to the railway line, and really it was only 500 yards or so. The set wouldn't work. Couldn't connect with my gun position. It was absolutely... and this was happening everywhere, and I believe at one time, the only communication that the division had with the rest of the world was through the BBC radio, one of the correspondents. None of the sets, apparently, would work. They got them working in the end, but they were real. Radios in those times, they were noise. You had to charge. You had these chore horses, we called them, charging the batteries, and they were great big things. The smallest ones you could carry on your back, but they were absolutely pretty useless. And it was tragic, of course. Communications were dreadfully difficult. And this was, I think, a problem during most of the battle. But we were there, and then we heard that we were in radio contact, things that improved radio-wise, with the guns of the Second Army. And I got up into the spire of this old church, and there was a little trap door, and I could see where the Germans were. I was told where the Germans were. We could see where you couldn't see the enemy, of course, Germans at that time. And I was directing fire of the medium guns from the Second Army onto where I knew they were, when the Germans wheeled up either a tank or a self-propelled gun, and they, of course, saw that I had to open this little trap door about three-quarters of the way up the spire, and they fired a shot. Unfortunately, it was about 3 feet too low, and we were sitting on an oak floor with me and my signaller. I was sort of observing the fire, and I said to him, because we weren't getting a proper response from the medium guns, because they were short of ammunition. They were having problems. And there was a great crash just below us, about 3 feet below where he should have shot. And Signer and I got sort of blown into the air a little bit, but I said, discretion is the better part of valor. We better get down before they can see where they missed. And they went on shelling a bit, and eventually, before the end of the battle, the steeple fell down completely. But those were chaotic days, and my commanding officer, Sheriff Thompson, had been put in charge by the general of what was originally called Thompson's Force, which was the area where the regiment was, and bits of infantry, bits of the parachute regiment. And there were really stragglers coming back. And I went out with Sheriff Thompson, and we sort of more or less took them by the hand and said, look, find you a rifle and dig in here, because these chaps had pretty tough time. I remember once telling me that he'd fired a Piat or something, supposed to be an anti-tank thing, and he reckoned he was only 7 feet from the German tank, and of course these were Tigers and Panthers, and everything bounced off them. I mean, virtually you had to have a 17 pounder to do anything with them, although my little guns knocked out several, but they were perhaps the lighter tanks during the battle. But that was at that time, one realized it must have been only about the third day, things were getting not going to plan, not at all. And I remember some chaps, I think they must have been, I think, from the 1st Brigade, whether they'd got to the bridge. I didn't think they'd got to the bridge. They'd been forced back. And they'd crawled in the dikes, in the water, virtually, to get back. And they came into the church, and they were soaking wet. And they took they call the hassocks, the inside out of the, and the kneelers and things, and made vests. They cut the corners off and put them on as dry vests. And also, that was a time when Major Lonsdale, Dickie Lonsdale, he got up on the pulpit and made his sort of speech to all these stragglers, as it were, all mixed people, mixed units, and he said, we beat him in North Africa, we beat him, and he was a very good morale raiser, and I was there at the time, although he wasn't addressing me, I could sort of hear him going on. But I remember some of these chaps coming back and then putting these sort of homemade vests on, and then saying, now let's get back to that bloody bridge. I mean, the morale was still pretty good. Some had been a bit shell-shocked, but really the morale stayed up amazingly well. And then there was a sort of haze of one day seemed much the same as the other. When we moved in, of course, the meadow was grass. By the end, it was all shell holes. You could step from shell hole to shell hole. And yet our little guns, the guns were dug in, well, not dug in, they had a little bit of a barrier because they had no protection. Our 75 millimeters had no shields, they were completely open. Our gun detachments were dug in and they had to put cover over their top because of mortar bombs were coming in. One slit trench, there was a very nice chap called Bombardier Pearson. We used to call him Granddad because I think he was 32 and married and two children and slightly deaf, and he looked out of his slit trench and just at the wrong time, and his head was more or less sliced off by a mortar bomb, and he sort of fell back in the arms of his best friend, who was called the Bombardier Rose, who became quite shell-shocked, and we put him, got him into the back of the church, and he was sort of lying there. And then the other troop commander from Easy Troop came in trying to find any spare people to do a sort of a bayonet charge at some Germans who were right on top of them, 100 yards away, facing the other direction, or 200 yards away. And this Bombardier Rose got up and said he'd join him. He'd been almost speechless before. And I gather when Tony Harrison, who was the troop commander, was wounded in the sort of charge, this chap took over. We tried to get him a medal, and we had the thing that it did irritate us. The message came back that your division has had the same ration of medals as an ordinary division gets in 6 months, and you were only there 10 days. And people who did things of immense bravery didn't get anything. I had another colleague who was cited for a military cross, which we'd have got anywhere else. And the point is that there weren't any other divisions who had the intensity of a war in such a short time. And when you think we took 10,000 people there, nearly 2,000 were killed in 10 days, just over 2,000 of us got out, and the rest were taken prisoner, and many of them were wounded. It was sort of casualties, and I think in the whole Korean War, which was a pretty nasty war in its way, I think there were 1,600 British casualties, something like that. And we lost more than that in those few days. So it was a really tough battle. Anyway, I say it became a sort of blur. There were certainly quite interesting things. The Germans, They had a train, the railway line went across a bridge which was actually blown by the Germans about half an hour before our 1st Brigade got to it. But in the early stages, we saw Germans on this top of this embankment. We had enough ammunition to fire at them with airbursts, so the shell burst above them, so that sort of made them put their heads down. But in the latter days, we were so short of ammunition that they were just, you could see them walking about looking at us, and we couldn't do anything about it. There was a 17-pounder gun just outside the church from the anti-tank regiment, and I went out one morning and found it had disappeared. I mean, I'd hope it was moved and not just shot to pieces, because there was jeeps and things all shot about everywhere. And in the end, our church was, we thought it was on fire, And my immediate senior, the senior subaltern who was gun position officer, said we must go move the command post out to a place which was under an apple tree, which we had chosen if we had to move. And he and I went out first to go to this place, and of course the Germans saw us and opened up with their mortars, and we both got hit. He got hit worse than I was, and I just got hit in the legs with mortar splinters, and we got him to the regimental aid post, the dressing station, which was the old rectory, as it were, which we had taken over as the regimental aid post, which was the home of this famous woman, Kate Horst, who was called the Angel of Arnhem, and who she was wonderful. But when I got there, which was, I think it was on the Sunday we were wounded, and because of the shelling, the dead couldn't be buried, and the house was sort of surrounded in corpses, which our own people who, you know, piled up, which was a little unnerving in a way. I had my wounds dressed and got back to the gun position. I had a funny incident in that, in fact, because just outside this porch, which the church hadn't actually caught fire, there was smoke, a lot of it had burned, but the main structure was standing. Just outside was a half-dug slit trench, and I remember jumping into it because, of course, the Germans again saw someone moving and they opened up with mortars and things. And I remember sitting down and feeling something sharp on my backside. And every time a sort of mortar bomb, I sort of crouched down and felt this. And I looked down when the things had stopped, and I found I was sitting on the unexploded fuse cap of a German 88mm shell. I never got out of a hole quicker. But, you know, again, one sort of laughed about it afterwards. But and it wouldn't probably have gone off if it hadn't gone off in landing. It would have probably not have gone off, but you don't think about these things at the time. And I got back into the command post, but I wasn't much good for anything because I was in a certain amount of pain, and the troop sergeant major, I think, was controlling the gun position. And this was on the Monday, and it was during on the Monday we had the orders to evacuate. And the one thing I feel, you know, it was quite astonishing, we had never, ever thought that we would be pulled back. We expected the Second Army to reach us, but nobody had even considered that we would have been withdrawn. And, I mean, in a way, of course, you felt it was quite a relief, you knew what was going to happen, but nobody ever even suggested that we should try and recross them on the river. And that organization was really rather incredible. The sappers had laid white tape down to the river. The perimeter, people from the perimeter, came from the furthest parts of it first. The wounded were left, and some of them were sort of firing shots and that sort of thing to make it appear that there was still the battle going on as the evacuation considered. We were perhaps one of the later ones, but I think I was helped by a couple of chaps to get down the river. And I think we started to move about 9:30, and I got into a boat about 3:00 in the morning. And we only had about 200 or 300 yards to go. And I think the Germans thought that we were being reinforced rather than we were being pulled back. And every time they sent flares up, we stood rigid. And it looked more or less like a hedge going down. I think this group of two or three men together and stock still when they might have seen us, I feel they must have thought it was a hedge or something like that. They didn't realize, in fact, till quite late, and then they obviously did realize what was happening. Anyway, I got helped into a boat by, I didn't hear till years later, by our regimental sergeant major, who then had to swim across the river. But they had these little boats, and they were obviously the ones that I went to, I think, were Canadian, manned by Canadians. And they had little two-stroke engines, which were always breaking down. I think the British ones were actually, they used oars or something like that. And they took about 12 men at a time, and they were shunting backwards and forwards, making awful racket, these. And I can't think why the Germans didn't wise up, except perhaps they thought there were people coming over, and they knew, quite honestly, that we were surrounded by these tanks and everything. They'd have wrapped us up the next day. We couldn't have lasted any longer, I don't think, because we virtually had no ammunition left. Our guns, the breech blocks were removed and the sights, and they threw them in the river and the streams, little streams around. They're still digging them up now. Yes, indeed, they're still digging up corpses, but there's still 63 unaccounted for, and they find two or three corpses a year in around the battle area. But anyway, I got back. I got onto some truck. It was taken to a first aid place where. A dressing field dressing station where they took my binoculars and pistol and arms. And I remember saying I had a grenade in my pouch there, saying, "Now be careful, I've got this grenade." And the chap who took it out said, "Well, says lucky you didn't throw it because it wasn't armed, hadn't got the fuse in, but I'd been given it by my brother officer. When he got wounded, he said, take my grenade. And so I would have felt a bit of a fool if I'd had to throw it, and it hadn't gone off. But the other thing, of course, officers at Arnhem, or probably anywhere else in the airborne division, we normally only carried pistols, or they were 9mm Browning automatics, which are pretty good weapons. But we all also had Sten guns with us. And this was because, obviously, the Germans, if they saw someone without a rifle or a Sten gun, took them as officers, and you were picked out accordingly because you were the sort of major target. Now, sadly, my commanding officer, Sheriff Thompson, was badly wounded, and Thompson Force became Lonsdale Force, and my original battery commander, who'd been promoted to called BMRA, Brigade Major Royal Artillery, he was killed, a chap called Tiny Madden. He'd had an accident, I think a driving accident, and was in hospital virtually when the Arnhem thing was all being got ready, and he discharged himself from hospital and got onto a glider and got to Arnhem, where he was killed, which was rather tragic. I mean, he wasn't really fit to go, but I mean, he was absolutely indomitable and amazing little man called Tiny Madden. And Sheriff Thompson survived. But it was a very confused battle. There was a thing which has been written up and reported. This regimental aid post, which a chap, our medical officer, called, we called him Randy Martin. He was the medical officer who'd ask the host's permission to use one room, and of course the whole house was full. That got badly shot up by a German tank, which came right into our position and